That's right. You are listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea K284AL Holly Eva, the station that loves you. And that was Joy Kills Sorrow, the band, and they're singing Get Along, and it's a great title for our show today. So this is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox Live, and this program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Canvas, the National Tropical Botanical Gardens Concert, Starry Nights, and so we love it when we have music coming.
Kauai Canvas, professional gallery quality giclée canvas printing and digital image capture now available on Kauai. Managing print flow, stretching, and even crating. More information at 212-6971 or online at kauaicanvas.com. Kauai Canvas, stretch your imagination.
Hanalei School's PTSA presents Starry Nights, 80s Rocker Dance Party, a fundraiser benefiting the students at Hanalei School, Saturday, March 1st at the St. Regis Princeville Resort. Doors open at 6:30. Silent and live auctions, photo booth, live music with the Jewel Tones, and dancing with DJ DKC. Prizes for the best 80s attire. A limited number of VIP tickets are available, including a three-course dinner at Makana Terrace. Tickets available at the Hanalei Surf Company, Magic Dragon in Princeville, and Healthy Hut in Kilauea. More information at 639-9011.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. We so appreciate you. So today, I just had said the song, Get Along. Well, how do we get along? We've got a number of topics that are going to come up and a few guests, and one of them who's in the house right now, I'm really happy to have David Cobb. Are you mic'd up okay?
I'm ready to go, Felicia.
That's so excellent. David Cobb called in last week. And spoke to us, giving us a little teaser for the event that you're doing. You're calling it Barnstorming Hawaii, and I love that thought. You're with Move to Amend. So tell us a little bit about Move to Amend, and then I'll help the listener. And in fact, while you're telling, help the listener from Kauai understand why on Kauai that is also very relevant.
Well, thank you, Felicia. So Move to Amend is a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition of groups and individuals from across the country who are coming together to demand the end of the legalized corporate takeover of not just politics, not just elections, but our very culture. And I come to this work as a 15-year lawyer. I have sued corporate polluters. I've lobbied elected officials. I ran for political office myself. I ran for Attorney General of Texas, pledging to use the office to revoke the charters of corporations that routinely violate health, safety, public interest, environmental laws. I ran for President of the United States on the Green Party ticket in 2004. And I'm proud to say I've been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience on a number of occasions. The point is, Felicia, that I have used all the tools available to try to create the systemic change that we so desperately need in this country. And that's what I want to focus on, that we have issues that we are constantly confronting, examples of corporate power. But it's time for us to recognize that corporations are not merely exercising power. They're actually ruling us. Corporate CEOs, unelected and unaccountable, are making the decisions about how our society operates, and they're using the legal system to legalize their abuse, their oppression on a day-to-day basis. Move to Amend says, let's go beyond issues. Yes, let's keep fighting for issues, and I have a number of issues that I work on as well, but let's get to the root cause of a legal system that has allowed and, in fact, encouraged and legalized the theft of our right to self-government.
So, do you have the verbiage when you say move to amend the Constitution? What is the amendment that they're choosing to amend? Do
yes,
you have that?
I do. The amendment language itself is at movetoamend.org, and if you just click on amendment, you can read the language. In essence, it has two parts. Number one, it would abolish the idea under law created by the courts that allows a corporation to claim to be a person with inherent inalienable constitutional rights. Secondly, that money is not speech. So let's subdivide those two. First, if a corporation is a person with constitutional rights, it means that corporate lawyers can try to overturn any law that we pass. And here's an example, Felicia. You, me, your listeners, as human beings, we do have inherent inalienable rights, and those are sacred. It means that government, through the political process, cannot infringe upon our right to free speech, or our right to assemble, or our right to worship, or not worship, however we choose. There are certain rights that we have that are human rights. And those are sacred, and those should always be protected. And the government and the political process cannot infringe upon our rights. But here's the thing. A corporation is an artificial entity created under state law. It's really just a concept that allows capital, money, and resources to be accumulated. And if accumulated wealth can claim constitutional rights, it means corporate lawyers can go into court and try to overturn any law that we pass. Environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, public health laws, campaign finance laws. There is a whole history of laws being overturned, majority positions, because the courts have held that corporations have constitutional rights.
So is there going to be a fresh amendment that would be overturning Citizens United? It seems like you're speaking almost directly to Citizens United.
Well, yes, and. So what I would say is, yes, Citizens United, and 100 years of history that actually covers other examples, because Citizens United was a horrible decision on campaign finance. It unleashed corporate money into our elections in a way that had never been seen before. And let's be clear, before Citizens United in 2008, $5 billion was spent during that federal election cycle, and that has gone up. Campaign expenditures have gone up every year for the last 50 years.
So I'm looking at it. Thank you, Larry, for pulling this up in front of me. Section 1 on House Joint Resolution 29, introduced February 14, 2013. It says, artificial entities such as corporations do not have constitutional rights. And the first line there, it says, the rights protected by the Constitution of the United States are the rights of natural persons only. I want to stop for a moment and talk about natural persons, because this has come up many times on this show. When we are Felicia Cowden in all capital letters, that is like a corporate entity of me, as opposed to capital F, small e, L-I-C-A, like, that's my human being.
Correct.
And so many people aren't really aware that you, even a human being, has a corporate entity. And that's, can you explain that a little bit? And will this upend that at all?
Well, I'm actually not familiar with the all capital letters that you're referencing. Mm. What I can tell you is this, that the concept of a natural person is a biological human being. And that's why we're very clear that only natural persons, actual human beings, living, breathing human beings, have inherent and inalienable constitutional rights.
Okay, and what, just, we won't go long on this, but like, if people look at their driver's license or Social Security or any document of ownership, like a title of a car or a piece of land, any of it always is in all capital letters. And that is the part that is affected by maritime law. And so that's our corporate personhood. And so here we have had a few people argue under their human being self and not their corporate self, because it is a separate set of laws that applies to human beings as opposed to the corporate entity. And so that's a deep thing that maybe we can get to off air, because I would really like you to be looking at that, because I think that that's something that I would like to see in this amendment. I was trying to look for it and didn't quite find it.
Yeah, you'd have to educate me about that, because I'm not familiar
with it. Okay, because it would be really nice if the citizens of the United States would be human beings with a capital first letter and the rest lowercase. Even if you look at United States of America, that is all caps, and that's a corporation, as opposed to the United States in America that came about with the Declaration of Independence. When the Declaration of Independence happened, it was uniting the different states that were in America, and there were no caps. And so United States of America, as in Hawaii, they are all corporations. So that's a big issue, but I'm liking what you're having there. So you would be making it be limited to human beings, and that would then reverse Citizens United.
It would definitely reverse Citizens United, and it would reverse a lot of the other court decisions, because remember, Citizens United, for the listeners who may not have dived into that particular case, Citizens United is a legal decision that came about because Citizens United, the nonprofit corporation, wanted to spend money in elections on a film called Hillary the Movie. The Federal Election Commission ruled that that was a violation of existing campaign finance laws under the McCain-Feingold law. You know, John McCain, Republican, Russ Feingold, Democrat, a bipartisan agreement that had overwhelming support, not only in Congress, but amongst the American people. Well, the court said, believe it or not, that campaign finance laws were treating corporations and the wealthy and trade unions like a, quote, oppressed minority, and that it was up to the court to come to the rescue of the rich and the powerful and to stop the government from restricting their constitutional rights. And that's the point, Felicia. Corporations don't have constitutional rights. Corporations are created under law through a state chartering process. And a corporation only has whatever privileges the apparatus is entitled to. But you, as a living, breathing human being, you have inherent inalienable rights. But a corporation only has privileges under law. So Citizens United basically gutted the campaign finance laws that existed up to that point.
Well, even on these elements about the living human being, this is going to segue for a moment of what a caller called in about history and our kupuna iwi, or our ancestors, our buried ancestors, particularly, I'm saying I because we're all claiming it, but particularly the Hawaiian ancestors, that is an issue where they lose over and over again. They have even like a burial council, but mostly they can choose between simply to build over the burial site or to dig it up and move it. And so for people who are interested in that issue, the East Side Burial Council is meeting March 7th, 5 to 9 p.m., Kapaa Library. So people called in wanting others to know about that and for us to stay conscious of that. There will also be tonight at Halehalawai a meeting down there about the Hanalei Courthouse. That's in Hanalei, 6 o'clock tonight. So if people are going down there to decide that. Your meeting tonight is at 6:30 at the Lihui Neighborhood Center.
That's right. I'll be here in this community in person. I have the honor of traveling across the islands, trying to help not only educate, but to organize people to be able to act effectively. You know, Felicia, we didn't exist as Move to Amend before 2010. Today, we have over 330,000 active participants. We have 150 local affiliates across this country. We've helped 500 communities pass resolutions in support at the city and county level, supporting our effort to amend the Constitution. And 16 states have passed non-binding resolutions of support. Hawaii was actually the very first state that passed it.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this was introduced in 2011, and it passed in 2012. The state of Hawaii has gone on record supporting an amendment to the Constitution to overturn the Citizens United case. And we put it on the ballot in almost 100 communities. And that means that not just elected officials, you know, 5-7 members of a city council have voted, but we put it on the ballot to let every voter in a community share their opinion. Do you think we should amend the Constitution to abolish corporate constitutional rights and money of speech? And here's the interesting thing. We put it on the ballot about 80 times. Felicia, we've won 80 of them. We haven't lost yet, including in Republican-dominated conservative areas like rural Wisconsin. You know, Scott Walker, the Republican mm-hmm. governor of Wisconsin, we put it on the ballot in his hometown, and we won. We put it on the ballot in the state of Montana, and we won. The point I'm making is the issue of corporations having too much power and corporate constitutional rights is something that transcends traditional politics. Whether you're a Green Party member, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, an Independent, there is almost universal agreement that these large corporations have hijacked our government, hijacked our politics, hijacked our culture, and it's going to take a movement of we the people to actually take our country back.
Well, even if you're, I want to call it the sovereign party, even if you're folks who are deeply questioning the United States' position here in Hawaii, it's still very relevant. It's still very relevant.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to say this. You know, I've had the since I called in, Felicia, and you gave me a little taste of the sovereignty movement that's happening here, I've done a little research. And I want to say I'm even more excited now because my read, it seems pretty clear that actually the United States of America is an occupying force on these islands. Actually, according to international law, Hawaii is probably not actually legitimately a state. So this is pretty deep. I mean, like, so I've just sort of been introduced to this idea. And the idea then led me into the knowledge that actually there's an active movement. See, it's not a secessionist movement in Hawaii. Because in Hawaii, the argument is we've never been actually properly annexed into the United States to begin with. In Vermont, there is a secessionist movement that says, yes, we properly came into the United States, but we want out.
Texas
has a secessionist movement. So there are multiple secessionist movements, but I just want to underscore Hawaii is actually not a secessionist movement. It's a true sovereignty movement because the claim is Hawaii was never properly annexed. And here's the point. It goes to the essence of what I know to be true, and we need to say this out loud. The United States of America is operating as an empire, but it's not the traditional nation-state empires of 100 years ago. This is a corporate empire. It is an empire that is funded by American tax dollars. The imperial machine is being lubricated with the blood, sweat, tears of injured American service personnel and the blood of innocent people, most who are brown and black skinned, who are having their resources stolen. But the point I'm making is this. It's not a nation state that's benefiting. It's only corporations that are benefiting. We know that the United States military was sent to Iraq to secure oil fields for oil corporations and oil profits. We know the history of the United Fruit Company, not only here in Hawaii, but throughout all of Central America. As soon as we begin to understand the role of the corporations in how foreign policy has actually operated, it helps us to understand domestic policy as well, and how now citizens of the United States are actually experiencing what it's like to be a third world country. And the difference is, even though we live in this land, corporations are coming in, extracting the resources, extracting the wealth, and saying that we, the people in a local community, don't even have the sovereignty to decide how our resources are being handled.
And we're going to take a caller. But yes, I think in Kauai and Hawaii, that voice has been coming out really loud and strong, that we're, that many people are feeling this is an extractive economy and exploiting the land use. And so you're very on point. So if people come there, they can even learn how they could put this on our next ballot.
Absolutely.
Would that go on the state ballot or the county ballot?
It would depend upon what the folks hear, because we don't dictate that. As the national leadership team of Move to Mend, we facilitate, we give resources, tools, and so forth, but we really empower local people to decide the tactics of whether it should be city, county, or state.
Okay, and we're going to take a caller, and I'm wanting the calls to be succinct because he doesn't have much time. David Cobb, Move to Mend, doesn't have much time here. You're on the air. Thank you for holding.
Thanks, David. I appreciate everything you said, and I support everything you said. The question I have, sir, is what would be the eventual outcome? Would there be a national constitutional convention convened?
Oh, what a fantastic question. And it really is, I'm not being sycophantic with you, sir. It's really an astute question, because Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution provides two mechanisms by which we can amend the Constitution. We've amended the Constitution 27 times. All of them so far have used one method, which is two-thirds of Congress make a proposal, and then it goes to the states for ratification. It requires three-quarters of the states to ratify. Your question is about the other idea, which is a constitutional convention. And I want to be clear. Article 5 of the United States Constitution provides that when two-thirds of the states call for a constitutional convention, then it is Congress's duty to call a convention. Any proposal that comes out of that convention will then be sent to the states for ratification. So, caller, your question is, are we supporting a constitutional convention? And our answer at Move to Amend is we are ambivalent. In other words, we don't care whether it's coming from two-thirds of Congress or whether it is a constitutional convention from two-thirds of the states, but we know this.
Point of clarification,
yeah,
sir. If Congress, in their great wisdom, in quotes, like ha-ha, would say, no, forget about it, you know, we're not going to, you know, move to amend the Constitution in any regard, then we would have under Article 5 this option of the states themselves being able to call for a constitutional convention?
That's correct.
So the only thing is, sir, doesn't this, I mean, I'm playing the devil's advocate right now, wouldn't this open all possibilities?
Well, what it would do is open the possibility for proposals, right?
Right.
But remember, the ratification process still requires three-quarters of the states to ratify any proposal. So my point is this, that there is a, whether you go from two-thirds of Congress or two-thirds of the states, that's a Y in the road that ultimately any movement has to come to. But there's a lot of political road that needs to be traveled before the decision of either Congress or a state convention is actually going to be called. So we're in the early stages. We're growing, getting larger, stronger, and better organized every day. But the ratification process provides the safety net, if you will, to make sure that whatever is proposed still has to have broad support, which is to say, at the end of the day, it's going to take a movement.
So you're thinking that the linkage, whether it's county or state and or state, that this would get the momentum going to for the states to petition or for our congressional representatives to hear this move to amend.
That's exactly right.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you, Felicia.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I really appreciate how you phrased the question around momentum, because, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, women were not granted the right to vote in this country. Women demanded the right to vote in this country, and they organized, they educated, and they built a movement. The civil rights movement, the trade union movement. See, these are movements. social movements are what actually make real change. Having good arguments, having a good analysis in a coffee shop doesn't actually change anything, right? And now, don't get me wrong, having good conversation is the first step towards understanding. Education is key and critical, but we've got to move to a kind of action step, a clear, intentional, deliberate campaign that is going to actually amend the United States Constitution. And that's what Move to Amend represents. And honestly, we haven't, I don't think that we've had a democracy movement the way that we've got now in a long time in this country. And frankly, I'd say it's about time.
Well, we do have a lot of citizen activism.
Absolutely.
Here. And what has really cultivated it, that I think, every pun intended, that has a lot of overlap with the Move to Amend issue, is the power that the biotech industry has over our university systems, our, you know, even our county too, and our state. I mean, it's been almost like the, to get more than 5% of the population to just be physically out marching, squeezing our poor county council into doing as we ask, than to immediately be faced with a lawsuit. That's one big issue. And last night I went to something on the smart meter things. There's a lot of pieces like that, really. The energy sector, who makes this money? Who gets to say? How does the power company get to give a mandate for every home and business?
You know, I'm so glad you made that point, Felicia, because let's really unpack what you just said. And that is that these corporate executives and the corporate CEOs are not merely exercising power. They're making public policy. You know, when you have, during the March Against Monsanto, you have hundreds of thousands of people, probably millions, actually worldwide, actually engaged, demonstrating what it is that they want. And a handful, I mean less than 20 corporate executives, are able to snap their fingers and have our elected officials dance. It makes us wonder, it makes us question, who are our elected officials actually accountable to? And that's why in Hawaii, I am especially interested in tying the Move to Amend effort and campaign to the campaign against genetically modified organisms, tying the Move to Amend campaign to the efforts to stop the pesticides and the commercial spraying. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is that there is incredible citizen activism on a number of fronts: environmental protection, worker safety, public health. But those are symptoms of the deeper problem. And the deeper problem is we don't actually control our own government. We the people are hallowed words in this country, but we the people have been usurped by corporations who have hijacked every single institution. And let's be honest, the only reason listeners are hearing this conversation is because we're on community radio. The reality is that we don't even have mainstream media anymore. It's corporate media, right? Huge transnational corporations literally control over 80% of the content that even is allowed to be heard or seen in this country. That's a problem.
And even at public radio, you know, we get a lot of pressure. You know, the pressure gets pushed on to the radio station about how much we should really be saying. It's really quite a challenge. I'm trying to look up here, too. I saw that our governor has wanted to appoint our head of agriculture in the House of Representatives, Jessica Woolsey. Do I have her name right there?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's like pulling our biggest ally who finally got positioned in the right place. All this stuff feels like a game of chess. Pulling everybody out, moving them in different places, you know, rigging a vote. And we saw even that kind of thing on both sides of this issue with the biotech challenge.
Well, I will say it this way. At Move to Amend, what we have recognized is that we cannot allow the leadership of any political party to dictate what our position is. In other words, Move to Amend is open to Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, Independents, sovereignty folks, But what we're and we would welcome, you know, members of the Democratic Party to participate. But what we're not going to do is allow the leadership of any political party to tell us how to proceed or influence our strategy, because that's the wrong approach. See, if you just go into the traditional activism, what we're typically taught is go to the power structures, go to the elected officials and lobby them and ask them, and they, you know, negotiate with them about what's possible. A movement is different. A movement is whenever you organize people to get so loud, so powerful that we dictate to elected officials what they're allowed to do. And that's, and it's time to really tell the truth here, Felicia. The leadership of the Democratic Party has actually sold out principled liberals. And the leadership of the Democratic Party is actually under the thumb of corporate America, Wall Street, and the big bankers, just as surely as the leadership of the Republican Party has sold out principled conservatives and are carrying the interest of Wall Street and the big bankers. We need a people's movement in this country that goes beyond parties and actually puts people in charge.
And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox Live. David Cobb is our guest from Move to Amend, and Larry Schneider, you've been talking to the callers. What are they saying?
One of the callers wanted me to ask you what gave corporations the legal right to become an entity and gain the protection, because he felt that in his recall, it was in the 1890s that it was proposed to Congress, but it was never voted upon, and it just happened without it being decided by a vote.
Yeah, he's mostly right. Let me actually give some of the specifics. I wish the caller had called in, and if you're listening, still listening, and you want to go into detail, we can, caller.
826-7771. He did call in, and he just keep talking.
Yeah, he is listening.
All right, so he's listening. Cool. So here's the thing: that the issue of corporations having constitutional rights was advocated and was never passed. Right? No state. States are chartered at the state level. It was never allowed. So the corporate lawyers began to go into the courts and made legal arguments to the courts to say, well, we want you to decide that that is true. And in a famous or an infamous decision called Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railway in 1886, there was a headnote, not even the actual opinion of a case, where the clerk of the court said the court said, just asserted, okay, we're not even going to hear argument on whether corporations have constitutional rights. We're all of the opinion that it is. And it was just announced. It wasn't even originally debated even in court. So the caller is 100% correct. It was never a legislative pronouncement. Our elected officials never did it. And the court created this concept out of whole cloth, and they did it illegitimately. And the last thing is this. The clerk of the court was actually a former railroad executive writing an opinion about a railroad case, the Southern Pacific Railway. So, and if anybody wants to go into detail, my good friend Tom Hartman has written a fantastic book called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Rights and the Theft of Human Rights, that is very elucidating.
Unequal Protection by Thomas Hartman.
Correct.
We have another caller. Thank you for holding. You're on the air. Are you there? Are you there? Hello? Not pulling him up.
It seems as if, as time goes on, nothing much has changed.
Well, in one sense, that's true, right? I mean, here's what we know. Throughout history, the wealthy ruling elite have attempted to exploit, to oppress, and so forth. But here's something else we know. That is that improvements have been made when ordinary people organize themselves, right? That whether we look at the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, anytime ordinary people have done the work of organizing ourselves, we've been able to affect systemic social change. And that's what Move to Amend is committed to doing, bringing ordinary people together to be able to exercise our inherent sovereign power.
And we do have that caller on now. Are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, what's your question?
I'm a different caller than the previous caller off air, but the comment and question I have is for the lawyer is, wasn't the impetus really started right during during the Civil War by the federal government?
Well,
thank you.
Yeah, it was during the Civil War, but it wasn't the federal government. Actually, the federal government originally was resisting the idea. The impetus was actually coming from railroad corporations and railroad lawyers and railroad executives. So, they were trying to use the legal system against the growing movement. And in fact, that's even in our sanitized history textbooks, we talk about the era of the robber barons, and those were railroad executives.
Yes, and during the Civil War, part of it was who was going to have, was the West going to be slave states, not slave states, and the industry in the West didn't really lend itself very well to that, but the South was pretty ticked that they had helped to build all the infrastructure for the North, and were even being asked to fund the building of the railroads while giving up their own economic arm, which was the exploitation of these people.
That's right, human beings. And let's also put a fine point on the notion that during that era, land larger than the entire state of Texas was given to these railroad corporations for no money at all, as one of the largest transfers of wealth that has ever happened in this country happened with gifts of right-of-way to railroad corporations of our land, we the people.
Well, I'm glad that you're making a lot of clarification on that. And here in Hawaii, we've had layer upon layer, and really, I think that there's a military grab. We have just had an issue of the west side, where we're next to Ni'ihau is another island that's part of Kauai County, and then almost in an overnight piece of legislation, it came out for Ni'ihau to become its own county. I want to give some thank yous out to our Senator Ron Kochi, who said, let's do a five-year study. I'm really behind doing a five-year study on that, because what many people fear, we have a rather powerful base on our west side, a military base that happens to be on Hawaiian homelands, that was land that was leased for next to nothing, that should be Hawaiian lands, sacred lands. And then many people are worried that this extension of turning Ni'ihau over to the Department of Land and Natural Resources is going to effectively just allow Pacific Missile Range facility to be that much larger and take over this other island, because the Ni'ihau Island County would also then include Kaula Rock and I'm forgetting, there's one more rock out there, one more island. I can't even believe I'm spacing on the name of it. But so if they take those three islands, one of which is lightly populated and individually owned by a single landowner, that all of a sudden everything is kind of maybe given away to the military in a way. So there's really big issues like the military. Do you look at that also as a corporate power? I know that's an extension of the U.S. government, but there's so many people in that industry. I shouldn't say people, organizations in that industry.
I think it's worth pointing out the Republican president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was, of course, a general who, after serving as president, his last speech goes down in history. His farewell speech is literally a warning to the American people, warning about a military-industrial complex taking over our government. That speech, again, written by a Republican, talked about how every bomb created is actually a theft. It's a theft against poor people who are going hungry. Every tank built is actually a theft against children who need to be educated. So, Felicia, when you point out the military, and I would have to be educated more about the individual issue here on Kauai, but I don't know. But I can tell you this, anytime the military actually finds itself involved in something, the interest of the American people is almost never actually being protected. And again, the military-industrial complex is an example of how foreign policy has been taken over by these corporations who are actually selling ammunition, selling munitions, selling technology to the government. And who's paying for it? Taxpayers. Whether you're a liberal, a conservative, a moderate, taxpayers are the ones that are actually paying for all of this military.
And it does seem really the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, which are seen as the left and the right, there's a lot of overlap between what their goals are.
There's no doubt about that, Felicia. And, I wish that we were on television right now just so I could do the visual. But if you could imagine, if you know the concept of a Venn diagram of circles, imagine one circle where you have the Occupy movement. And what is Occupy angry about? Well, it was in its name, Occupy Wall Street. They were angry at Wall Street. Now imagine another circle that's the Tea Party movement. And what were they angry about? Well, government, specifically the government bailout of Wall Street America. So you put those two together, and the overlap is the reality that Wall Street America has basically taken over government, and government is issuing policies that are and legislation and laws that are really only benefiting the wealthy Wall Street bankers and so forth. I actually think that if we spend the time to really listen to one another and say, you know, we're going to have disagreement on issues and policies, but let's look for where our common agreement is around principles, around core principles, not around issues, because there's going to be political debate around different issues, but around the values of sovereignty, the values around how only human beings should have constitutional rights, the reality that these huge corporations and Wall Street have basically hijacked our country. There is actually common ground amongst occupiers and Tea Party folks. And I'll tell you something, that combination makes me excited to imagine about us being able to come together, find that kind of common ground and say, we may fight like heck once we have control over this government again, but right now, let's fight over the fact that we're actually supposed to be in charge here, not these corporations.
And David Cobb, I'm glad you're going to be at the Lihue Neighborhood Center at 6:30 today to be answering some questions. I'd like to have a couple other really intelligent guests in my studio here, Larry Schneider, who's helping me if he has any questions. And then coming on is Amigo Bob, who you have done amazing things in the agriculture industry. I shouldn't even call it industry, but the organic movement. So I'm wanting to allow both of you, Larry, maybe we'll start with you, of any questions of David on this, and then Amigo Bob from you also.
The concept of amending the Constitution seems like a great idea, but from a practical perspective, it sure seems as if the companies get their freedom to operate and lack of oversight through legislation that is before the level of Constitution. It occurs in the state, it occurs in the United States Congress and Senate. And I always scratch my head and I'm puzzled about, we have a government that's passing laws that give infinite protections to corporations. And a lot of times the legislation is written by attorneys for the entities. And how do you get the amendment to pass? Yet, and you can get the amendment to pass. How do you make certain that there's enforcement and that it brings about the change that you're wanting it to bring about?
Well, Larry, I appreciate that question, because inherent in it is the answer, which is to say, it's not a question of just writing a good law. It's not even a question of writing a good proposed amendment. Unless and until there is a genuine social movement in this country that is broad, that is, it cuts across political ideologies, it cuts across sectors, races, etc. But that movement must also be deep. It must be conscious. It must be educated. It must be aware. And then lastly, it must be militant. And by militant, I mean it must make demands upon elected officials. Move to Amend is going to be rolling out a Pledge to Amend campaign where we're actually forcing candidates for office, whether they're an incumbent or a challenger, to tell us their position on corporate constitutional rights. And, you know, I'd love to hear from Amigo Bob, especially as somebody who is active in the organic movement, because here's what we know. We know that there were people who were already very much aware of how much more effective the yields were. And by the way, organic, you know what our grandparents called organic, don't you? Organic farming? They called it farming, right? It was just farming. So this knowledge is actually ancient knowledge. But it did not really take off until about 20 years ago. A couple of visionaries began to lay the intellectual framework for it that began to educate more and more people. And now there's a full-fledged movement in this country that's actually challenging for the first time, probably, the actual sort of corporatization of food production and distribution in this country. And it's being successful not because of the ideas. The ideas are powerful. It's being successful because it has actually educated and mobilized a broad section of the American people to self-identify as supporters of the organic farming movement. That's my read on it and how I would actually see the overlay.
And amigo Bob, and do you say your name? Cantasano. Okay. Cantasano. Okay. Do you have a follow-up question for that? Because that's been your lifelong work, really.
Yeah, I want to respond to David's comments. Well, people are fed up with their food supply, and that's stimulated a whole reaction. And it takes human beings quite a bit, especially Americans, to actually get to the point of being fed up, because we're fed so well.
And, that's a good line.
It is, in fact, and I stole that from someone else. I'm not going to claim it as my own, but
I will when I speak in public, but
good,
go ahead.
It's good. But you know, this whole phenomenon that's going on with the organic food movement, it comes from people's sincere interest in being further closer connected to their food supply. I think the challenge, and I'd like to hear you speak on this, is how do we get people more further closer connected to their political, to their constitutional rights? By the way, I'm from Nevada County, California, where Charlie Price is leading our group. I'm a member of it, and I'm really proud that we're actually rattling some cages. But I think it's got a long ways to go before we can make a big change in our county, which is a mix, a real social and political mix, which was what we need to do. We can get the far right, the far left, and those in the middle to combine. So I'm just curious how you stimulate that process.
Well, I think that I'm so glad that you asked the question, and I do want to acknowledge the fact is that Americans are getting really agitated because they're learning about the corporatization of their food production and distribution. And one thing that we've seen is like when you can create mechanisms like community supported agriculture where people are encouraged to actually know the farmers who are growing the food, and maybe you even organize some trips out to the farm where you actually see your food being produced, and you know, and you get connected to it. And I want to be clear about this, amigo Bob. It means a spiritual connection as well. It means recognizing that how connected we are to one another and to the earth itself. It begins a different thought process, right? So when you ask me how can we get people more connected to our constitution and our own, what in my mind, it begs the question, how do we get people to recognize we actually already have far more power than we realize? We're just not coordinated and collectively exercising our power. So I do look to the organic food movement. I look at the GMO campaigns. I look at Occupy. I look at Tea Party. I'm always interested in looking to see what is it that other people have done before us to be able to be effective social change agents. And one thing I know is this, that you have to do it as horizontally as possible. As soon as you lift up one person or one group of people who are going to be the leaders telling the rest of us what to do, then nobody really feels empowered and you kind of lose steam. Real movements have got to empower local folks. And Nevada County in California is a perfect example, right? In Nevada County, the local Move to Amend affiliate, they're deciding how to proceed. Yeah. They're deciding what to do. We're not telling them what to do from national. We're encouraging. We are a resource. We're networking with one another. But I think you empower people by actually empowering them and encouraging them to make the kinds of decisions. Yeah. So that's a little taste of it. And I think that there are 150 other affiliates of Move to Amend across the country that are experimenting and in similar ways. And to me, that's actually the strength of this movement, is by being horizontal and really encouraging people to get active in their own community. Wherever you live, work, and play, that's where you've got the most power.
And that was Nevada City that you were speaking about,
yeah,
right
Nevada
there.
Nevada County. Nevada City's part of that.
Okay, yeah. Nevada County and Nevada City. I did have a caller with a really excellent point, and he brought up ALEC, the organization ALEC, and I think that that's really critical that people understand it. When I first became aware of it and I discussed it with my policymakers, they hadn't even ever heard of it.
Right.
And so, ICLE is kind of somewhat, if you see how ICLE comes into that too, do you follow that at
all? So let's deal with ALEC. ALEC stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. It is a corporate mechanism by which literal laws, proposed legislation, are being drafted by corporate lawyers, and then they have these lavish, elaborate weekend, sometimes week-long seminars where the corporations pay our state elected officials to come to be fed, wined and dined. They pay for all the hotel. They pay for all the food. They pay for child care. They pay for everything. And then they try to convince legislators to propose legislation in their respective states that the corporations actually wrote.
Yeah, it's like franchised policymaking.
It is, right? That's exactly what it's like. Oh, and by the way, here's some examples of that. The Florida Stand Your Ground laws that actually were written by the gun manufacturers. That's an example of an ALEC bill. All the prisons, the
Correctional Corporation of America.
Correctional Corporation of America.
Which Hawaii is a part of that.
Yep, right. I mean, so
and
all
the standardized tests.
Standardized testing and education. I mean, we could go down the list, right? And what you're seeing is this is legislation that is actually, by every conceivable understanding, would actually be against the public interest. It's corporate interest, written by corporate lobbyists, and that the legislators are passing it on their behalf.
Because they're wined and dined and lobbyists get to them, and a whole host of other reasons. One of the problems that people have is, one, they can't understand the bills that are written by the corporate attorneys for their benefit. And it doesn't just happen at a national level. We're dealing with that with the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Oh, my God, yes.
In which no one, if you get the information, you're committing a crime.
How about that?
So,
think about
so
that.
So to get knowledge, we now live in a country where to obtain knowledge, it becomes a criminal activity.
And Larry, I'm going to actually the Trans-Pacific Partnership at the national level is a perfect example of that, right? And let's name this. The Obama administration and the Democratic Party leadership are trying to force a secret trade deal down our throats that would basically have us in a race to the bottom for both environmental protection standards and worker safety and pay, right? And for the first time would create under our law the opportunity for corporate lawyers to go into court to try to overturn laws because it violated the right to profits. This has never happened before.
Not the opportunity.
Not the opportunity.
They shall have the right.
They shall have the right to
be compensated for
lost profit.
Diminished profit, whether real or in concept.
Based
correct.
On other people's
And by the way, just to put as if that's not insane enough, what Larry has just brought up, callers, check this out. That legal argument is brought to a secret tribunal, international, violating any concept of sovereignty of the United States of America. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is probably the worst example of the corporate takeover of our government, and the fact that the leadership of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in Congress are supporting it is part of our problem.
And our representative, Tulsi Gabbard, is definitely fighting it. So, David Cobb, I have one more caller for you. I know you're going to be leaving soon to be able to go to your event at Lihue Neighborhood Center where people can talk to you in person.
Right on.
Aloha, caller. Thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, what's happening? Can you hear me?
I can. Have you been listening in?
I've been listening for a little while, yeah, for sure. I have a question. So tonight, is there a fee to come in, or is this a free?
No, no, it's totally free.
No, that was my first one. And then the other one is, you know, as I listen to you guys, you know, one of the things is they've got to educate these young guys, because I have kids. And, like, my daughter, you know, I can tell you it's abnormal. None of her peers are even, they don't know anything about civics or anything what's going around them. You know, mine's 15. And I micromanage a little bit obsessively. I mean, I'm class free at Tapah. And I'm from Kapahi. I'm from Kauai. And, you know, I was the last, you know, part of the last part, the tail end of the plantation era, you know, where they dumb me that down, you know, make you compliant, happy with your life. But, you know, that's his own story. But my point is that I woke up one day, you know, and you got to pay rent and all that. And, but, you know, my girl is 4.0, and, you know, she's top of her class, and she's actually been invited to go to Washington, D.C. to a national young leaders conference in the summer, which I'm going to, you know, even if I got to sell a motorbike, I'll make her go to that. But my point is, like, some of your efforts that you guys are doing here, I know that they're not registered voters, but they soon will be, and they're going to be the next generation. So if they're not learning civics in the right way, if you're not putting some energy into the youth, you know, you guys are a whole generation that's not involved.
Well, I can tell you that I think you're absolutely right about that. And I also want to lift up, you're right. The current corporatization of education is an example of the fact that the ruling elite are very afraid of us actually being educated and organized. Now, Move to Amend actually has an entire youth component. On our national leadership team, we have several people in their 20s and 30s. We spend a lot of time actually in high schools and in universities actually giving this basic presentation. It's a shame that civics is not taught, but we at Move to Mend are doing our best to teach civics to young people. And if anybody is interested, just go to the website movetoamend.org. You can find a wealth of information, but you can also find information about how to get involved in educating yourself and educating others.
So thank you, caller.
Before I hang up, I just wanted to point out that I've made an observation that with all the problems globally and all the plight, it's almost like a battered child syndrome where they build a self-defense mechanism. And there's this whole mentality of this newer generation, the teens now, not the 20s and the 20s, late 20s, you know, these 12, 13, 14s, where there's no aspiration. When I ask them what they want to be, what they want to do.
Well,
you know, when you're a kid, you know, when you're a kid and you used to play the game, oh, when I grow up, I'll be on doctor, I'll be on policeman, right? They don't even have that nowadays.
I have to concur with that for the most part. You're right.
Hey, caller, my daughter went to the National Youth Leadership Foundation in Washington, D.C.
So did my son.
And it was, it will help your daughter.
Yeah, I paid my down payment, so I'm going to come up with the rest of the tuition.
Right on. Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
No problem. Aloha.
Aloha. So, David Cobb, you're going to be leaving in just a few moments to be on time for your event at the Lihue Neighborhood Center at 6:30, which is across the street from the hospital and Malkaside from Walmart, if people are wanting to go. What final thoughts do you have for the Kauai listeners, and what can they expect at that meeting?
Well, first, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity on these airwaves. And remember, these are public airwaves. They actually do belong to us. But to access the airwaves, it actually requires infrastructure. So I just want to remind listeners that KKCR is community radio. And the reason that we're able to have this information and to have the great music that you don't normally hear on corporate media is because this is a community radio station. So I hope you'll remember that during Pledge Drive so that we can get this, keep this valuable tool at our disposal. Because here's the thing. We're getting larger, stronger, and better organized. Move to Mend has never been covered a single time by the corporate media. It's only been people's media and the internet and social media and Facebook. We're growing. Move to Amend is getting larger, stronger, better organized. We're already at 330,000 people. We hope to actually get a Move to Amend affiliate here on this island. So if you're interested, please come by if you can. If you can't make it in person, sign up online at movetoamend.org so that we can make sure to get your information to the local organizers who are interested in forming a Move to Amend affiliate here.
And who is hosting you tonight? Is it Kauai Rising or is it the Kauai Alliance for Peace and Social Justice? Okay, excellent. And they do many, many wonderful things. So David Cobb, mahalo nui, as we'd say, mahalo nui loa. Thank you so very much for coming to Kauai and going around to all the different islands. You're much appreciated.
Well, thank you. And mahalo to you and aloha.
Aloha. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa, the station that loves you. This is Felicia, Kauai Soapbox Live, and it is made possible by listeners like you with Bali High Realty, Anahola Stringed Instruments, Aya's Garden, Al Pastor Tacos, and NTBG Concerts.
The National Tropical Botanical Garden presents the Musical Legends in the Garden Concert, Saturday, April 5th, featuring 13-time Grammy winner Jerry Douglas on the dobro, plus Hawaiian legends Ledward Ka'apana, Dennis Kamakahi, and Mike Ka'ava, a trio of Nathan Aveau, Jeff Peterson, and Benny Chong, plus local favorites Ken Emerson, Poncho Graham, and Kirby Keough. The concert celebrates the 50th anniversary of the nonprofit National Tropical Botanical Garden. More information and tickets available online at ntbg.org and ticket outlets islandwide.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored designs and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Al Pastor Tacos supports KKCR across the street from the craft fair in Kapa'a by the beach. Al Pastor Tacos serves fresh grilled local fish, steak, chicken, and pork tacos and burritos in the Al Pastor style. Also a garden salad and choices for the kids. Open every day from 11 to 4. Takeout orders welcome. Al Pastor Tacos, authentic Mexican food. 652-6953.
Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, and Hanalei, serving Kauai since 1978, providing personalized real estate sales and rental services. Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, also supports KKCR and the Kauai Independent Food Bank. More information at balihigh.com or by calling 826-7244.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. This is Kauai Soapbox Live. I do have one quick caller who's holding, and then we are going to go into a focus with amigo Bob Contisano. Is that, do I have your name right? He put his thumb up. It sounds Mexican, is that right?
Italian.
Italian, oh, okay. Oy vey, I should have known. I'm Italian, but okay, we're going to take this call. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, Felicia.
Yes.
Hi, this is John.
Yes.
Hi, I'm calling, you know, I called this program to talk to people about the driving on the beach thing before.
Yes.
I wanted to let people know that another man was run over on our beach by a hit-and-run driver.
And, which beach?
It was in Waimea. The guy was fishing and got run over by a guy who ran over him, cursed, said, "Are you alive?" And he saw him move, and then he drove off, you know, and he left him there. And the guy said he laid there for the longest time. Finally, somebody picked him up and took him to the hospital.
Mm.
And you know what, Felicia? This guy could have been one of your kids. And, you know, I just don't understand the complacency around this because according to Joanne Yukimura and other officials in the state, motor vehicles are not allowed by law on our beach. Period. There's no exception. We're no different than any other island, and motor vehicles are not allowed. So our local officials have been given out this illegal privilege that has resulted in this kind of stuff. Plus, state marine biologist Don Heacock said publicly in the Garden Island paper on August 4th, 2013, that it was destroying the environment, that it was interfering with nesting sea turtles, that it was destroying, causing erosion on the dunes by destroying vegetation, that it was crushing a peaky crab hole, and he went on and on, draining dangerous chemicals into the bays, fragile bays, and on and on. And I can't understand how really anybody who pretends or says they care about the environment could not be concerned about driving on these beaches for our safety. And it's also ugly. You go to a beautiful, pristine beach, and all of a sudden you're laying there enjoying the scenery. All of a sudden, from a half mile away, you hear the blum, blum, blum of a big Ram diesel truck barreling down the beach at 25, 30 miles an hour, usually propelled by somebody who's been drinking, coming through, leaving dirty marks, spraying you with diesel fuel, and that doesn't, you know, it doesn't, it's not nice.
Well, thank you, John, for calling that in. How is the person? Did you find out? Do you know that person?
I'll tell you what it is. The guy said when he was run over, he was in so much pain he couldn't get the license plate. The guy drove off. The police never located the hit-and-run driver. It's a man who comes here every year, has family here, and was visiting 2 years every year just to go fishing. And he's a blue-collar worker. It left him maimed, and it destroyed his life. And it left him fearful. And, you know, Felicia, this could have been your child. And I'm curious, just one-on-one with you, because I've never heard you say about this, what do you think about this? Do you think it's okay to drive on these beaches, knowing it's 100% against the law, people are being hurt, and the environment is being destroyed, not by my word, but by these, you know, by the articles in the newspapers and public
declarations. Okay, John, well, like, I don't drive on the beach, and I feel very bad if people are getting run over on the beach. And, you know, I guess I don't have a huge, huge strong opinion. Everything that you're saying makes sense. All of those things are bad. I think I've got another caller waiting to respond to that, and then we are going to drop the conversation because I have a person in here that is a scheduled guest. But I appreciate that this is very important. I get it that it's very important, and
well,
I don't want.
Would you give me one more second, please? And I'll wrap it up. I'm not going to drag it out. I'm not going to make an issue. I'm not
okay.
trying to make
one,
people
so,
angry.
So one more moment.
I'm just trying to provide
okay. So say your next point.
My next point is that the only person on the state level I found that will help is Malama Solomon, who is a state senator from the Big Island. She oversees DLNR.
Mm-hmm. She's the one who's the very pro-GMO person. Yes, that's correct.
But she's also in charge of overseeing DLNR. She's planning to hold a hearing to investigate this, so maybe some good fruit will be bore from this. But I just want to let everybody know it's basically our local officials, the local head of the DLNR, our police, and our mayor who have hijacked these beaches to be given to a certain number of people who want to do this dangerous illegal activity under the guise of cultural privilege.
Right. I do understand.
Really,
it is a part of the culture.
You know, I used to be mad. Now I'm just sad and heartbroken. So.
Well, my prayers are out there for this person who was run over, and I hope that doesn't happen to anybody else.
I personally hope he sues the state and the county for about $100 million because it's the only way that they're going to wake up. And I mean, I don't think the state should be punished, but you know, people are asleep, and they just don't want to move out of their cathartic realm, you know.
Okay, John, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Aloha, you're on the air for a quick response.
Sure. First of all, the beaches are run by different people. One is run by the state, one is run by the county, so it's on like an individual case. Second of all, I'm a fisherman, and we use our vehicles to get ourselves into places. You know, unfortunately, there's a few bad apples. There's bad apples on the regular road, too. You know, this guy sounds very unhappy, and I hate to throw this card out there, but, you know, it's political suicide to go against this issue. Because there's a lot of abiding people that use their vehicles, and many people that move here from the mainland like to be on the beach with their trucks. You go behind kitchens on the weekend in Wailua, and it's mostly white people. It's not even a fisherman's mostly. We've been taken over by the recreational guys.
But the surfers,
Wait, you got to understand something. This falls under right of way. The guy doesn't understand. There's a harvesting right. We have the right to go fishing. We can camp if we have a fishing pole. We don't need a camping permit. As long as we're actively fishing, we can camp anywhere we like. Okay? And so that guy doesn't realize we have a harvesting right over here. That's in the state constitution from way back, da-da-da-da-da. Even like water rights. We can traverse through your property up the river if we like. You cannot tell us we cannot harvest prawns.
Okay.
And so I just wanted to tell the guy that, it's bad that the guy got run over. I got run over by a truck on the road, and I'm an amputee because of it. I didn't get $100 million. So the guy's out of his mind. You only get about $400,000 for a loss of a limb. Better wake up. Okay? I just wanted to put that out there.
Did you really lose a limb?
Yes, I'm really an amputee from a vehicle, and I was on my motorcycle, and he was 100% at fault. You don't get $100 million for that.
I'm sorry that you were hurt.
No, I'm not being bitter, but I'm lucky I'm alive. I don't even care about that. I still fish. I still do all that. I don't even care about that. I'm going to tell these guys to get hyper-excited. And that's the kind of guy we don't need over here trying to change our way of life. It's a bum trip that guy got run over. Get the license plate and get that individual. And some of us use our trucks to get our fishing gear and camping gear in and out.
Okay, thank you for sharing that perspective.
All right, aloha. Bye.
Aloha. Okay, Amigo Bob, thank you for coming in. Thank you for, you are also putting on an event. We've got a great permaculture event coming out. I mean, it's underway right now with Skeeter Pilarski for 2 weeks. I see that you are doing one that's going to be really great for helping people who don't have that kind of time on Tuesday, March 4th. From 8:30 to 4:30 at Waipa. So that's great. People can look on the website or call you at 530-913-5515 if they want to learn anything about costs on that. It's not an exceptional charge. I cannot say that the price on the air. So you, please tell us about yourself, because it looks like to me that you've had a whole lifetime of supporting the resurgence of natural farming and the organic food movement. But I want to say resurgence because it didn't start with you or anybody at this point. It happened. It was always the case until it got supplanted at one point.
Well, thanks first for inviting me in, Felicia. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. My grandma was an organic gardener, but she didn't know what that meant. She grew garden the way that her ancestors did it. The whole evolution of the use of chemicals, genetic engineering, and all the agribusiness that we're dealing with is relatively a new phenomena. You asked about my own history. Well, you know, I came out of the 60s as a activist frustrated by the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, and other factors, and there was an overwhelming amount of issues, as there always is if you pay any attention at all, that looked very difficult for me to do anything about, you know, personally. So I decided that I would focus on something I could do something about, which was grow food, and became a farmer, and then from that farming, broaden that into activism. Because it isn't enough just to grow your food. You have to deal with all the other issues that have to do with growing food. So I've spent the last 40-plus years involved in a wide variety of issues that are political in nature and social change. And now we call it a movement. It, you know, nobody forged a movement. It's a number of us who started off effectively saying, look, we need to go back to the roots of how we grew food for thousands of years. And yet, we also have to learn the modern methods because it's a mixture. And in my work as a farmer and a farming advisor and an activist, I've had both the pleasure and challenge of spending innumerable amounts of hours with conventional farmers that grow large acres of crops using chemicals. And I came to the conclusion a long time ago that they weren't the enemy. They were actually our allies. And they had been duped politically and socially, just as most of us have been duped about the medical system or the veterinarian system. That, in fact, the wisdom that farmers inherently have basically got taken away from them, and it was dumbed down and told to them the only way to succeed in agriculture was to utilize these magic potions that came, you know, no farmers ever invented any of these pesticides. None of this stuff came from that community. So these things were brought to them by the experts, same experts that brought you the education community and the pharmaceutical community in the form of drugs or psychiatric work or human health. All this is the same group of people. Where David's talking about the corporatization of America, it's all tied to this whole phenomena. So what I work on is unwinding the brainwashing that the farm community's gone through. And I make the majority of my income as a farming advisor. I teach conventional farmers how to become organic farmers. And I also teach organic farmers how to become better at farming organically. And that's one of the reasons I'm here. I've been doing farm advising here on Kauai for about a little over 20 years and over around the world for about 30 years. And what I'm interested in is seeing organic farmers get more competent and successful at farming, so that they will be able to be successful and make a good living and act as models for others so that more people will be interested. That's really my focus, is to try and get people motivated through action instead of talking. And I'd love to talk, but, you know, it's about doing is what farming is about.
And have you had the opportunity to speak to our legislators and policymakers? Because I did have a meeting with a number of people from the West Side with their representative from there. And I think was something that came out pretty clearly to me is that mindset that real farming, meaning large-scale export-level farming, requires pesticides. And how do we help dislodge that meme? I know that it seems to me that it must need a little bit more of a permaculture style, maybe not so much monocropping, but what, how can you speak to how we can do large scale agriculture without pesticides?
Well, first I'll say that I have had 30 odd years of experience dealing with government and regulators and universities, and that dogma has been thrown around ever since back at the beginning of organic farming. What I can also tell you is that my largest client farmed 6,500 acres of organic vegetables last year. And people said you couldn't do that. You know, it's impossible. You know, all the naysayers said, oh, you can't. You know, yeah, that's okay. This hippies could do an acre of it. But how could you make this commercial and do this on a scale where people could afford it and also that it looks like something? So we're talking about mindset. That's really what you're looking at here. So the whole issue of can they do it? Sure. This isn't any kind of agriculture. I've worked in all scales of agriculture. My largest client, one post, 25,000 acres of crops, and they transitioned about two-thirds of those. And if they had the market, they would have transitioned all of it. It wasn't a technological issue. It was a marketing issue. So if farmers wanted to farm organically and the market would support them, yes, they need to make changes. Sure, you need to have a better polyculture system, not a monoculture. You need to take better care of your land. You need to increase the organic matter, and you need to get the biological activity more in balance, and you need to stabilize the ecosystem by taking out the toxins. But it's not scale dependent. That can be done on a square foot or a million square feet or much larger than that. It's more a fact of the farmer setting the mindset that it can be done. And once a farmer believes they can do it, and most of these people I work with, they're conventional farmers. They're completely hook, line, and sinker sucked into this whole deal. And they have unwound themselves and said, gee, you know, I was just brainwashed. And once they realize that that's a function of what's been taking place and they see that there is ecological balance established and potential on their farms, their scale is not the issue at all. So out on the West Side, well, the issue out on the West Side is they need to develop crops that have a market for them outside of the GMO crops. The GMO crops are out there because there's a market for them. And as long as there's a market for them, somebody's going to grow them. And, you know, corporations will come in and rent land, or individuals will do that as long as there's a market. And so, you know, so that's where consumers come into it. As long as we keep buying into GMOs are not a problem and it's not going to affect us and all the other propaganda that you hear, farmers are going to step up to the plate and grow whatever the marketplace wishes for. So on the West Side, so far, they're not being asked to grow. And if they were interested to, they could grow it. There's perfect soils out there to grow great crops, great climate. But you'd need to see a whole change in how the actual system would be.
And then detoxifying it, I see that you were part of an integrated pest management program for Nevada County. So that's kind of a big deal. Some people are saying maybe hemp would be a good crop to grow in to start extracting some of the toxins from sugar, because we're making some headway on that, both at the state level and the federal level in Congress. It hasn't been passed, but it hasn't been killed yet in the legislature at both levels.
Well, interestingly, the Farm Bill, which just passed 2 weeks ago, provides a funding mechanism for hemp production in the United States.
So it passed.
It passed, the Farm Bill did, yes.
Okay.
Now, there are other legal hurdles. And California passed a hemp production law, as to some other states. And the first hemp in the United States was grown in the last 70 years, was grown on a crop commercially in southern Colorado and harvested with full knowledge of the FDA and the USDA. So now, back to the question of, is that going to solve the problems on the west side? Well, that's one piece. You know, you need to have a multiple layered phenomena. The issue in to grow hemp is, you can, anybody can grow it. It's not a difficult crop to grow, but it also needs to be developed into a product. So in order to do that, you'd have to have the infrastructure. So you don't have to ship it off to China or some other third world country to process it, which is where all the hemp's coming from now, is that it needs to be developed, the market need to be developed, and the production processing facility equipment. Sure, you could grow that here. It'd be an easy crop. But there's lots of other crops that could be grown here if the market and the infrastructure is developed. And that's the real issue. And when you look at an island, the vast majority of the food consumed here is brought here from somewhere else. There's a huge opportunity if the knowledge was there and the interest by both the growers and the consumers to eat something that was locally grown.
Well,
and
I see
that's happening, but it needs to be expanded.
I've been running into you a few different years now at POI, at WIPA, so maybe you want to come out here and help us do a little bit with setting up farmer cooperatives. I see that you've been a technical advisor even in Costa Rica and other places like that, and it looks like you're actually vertical in the industry. Mountain People Catalog, you were part of that as well?
Yeah, I helped start the food cooperative that eventually started the trucking company that eventually became Mountain People's Warehouse that eventually became United Natural Foods. Yeah.
Okay, so you're in the germination phase more than...
I'm not involved with it. That was in the 70s.
Okay.
But, you know, that came from, let's speak about that process. You know, our food buying club said, hey, we want to grow, we want to have more of our own food. So first off, let's start farming some. So I became farmer for the food buying club. Part of the food buying club started to develop gardens. The buying club then got more popular. It moved into a storefront, became a food co-op. The food co-op outstripped the ability of the distributors to bring the product to them. They bought their own truck in order to feed themselves. Then once they put the truck on the road, they said, gee, we're only using it one day a week. What about the other 6 days of the week? Soon there was a trucking company that provided for other food co-ops and farmers to get their food to the marketplace. And then that grew and grew and grew and grew until eventually there was a very large-scale natural foods distributing company, cooperatively owned, and then that got sold to a private individual, took it on, and became what became known as Mountain People's Warehouse. But that all started from the collective action of a few people saying, you know, we can do something about our food. So this is not, well, anything unique. People have done this all over the planet, but you need to have that desire and motivation to do that.
Well, I think the paradigm at the policymaker level is something that's really important to be shifting. Right now, what I've seen from the Department of Agriculture, they look at organics and natural foods as a boutique product.
Yep.
And that for any reasonable level of farming, they need water, sun, land, fertilizers, and pesticides. You know, that tends to be the mindset that they're having.
Sure.
So in the last question I asked you, do you work directly with the policymakers?
Yeah, I've been on I've been on farm advisory boards for the Farm Bureau, the University of California, the State Department of Food and Agriculture. I'm actually a technical advisor to the Department of Pesticide Regulations chief person. So, yeah, I think you have to get involved with that process.
And were they receptive? We have a bill out right now that I'm concerned about. I will own my bias there on 2524 in the Senate, and that is a bill that is wants to put a task force together to deal with the genetically modified organism product line, both for labeling or how to deal with it in any way. But when I look at the stacking of how they want to build that board, to me it looks like 9 out of 11 votes are going to for sure see it from the side of the industry.
Yeah, they always try to do that. Again, this is the corporate model. You stack, you either write the legislation so you can't understand it, you and I can't, or you stack the board so that they're guaranteeing the, even with a regulatory process, they're guaranteeing no action. Yeah, I've been through that process. It's very difficult. And you have to be perseverant. All they can say is right now in California, for the first time, we now have allies in the Department of Food and Agriculture and the Department of Pesticide Regulation, which we didn't have. You know, we didn't have when Jerry Brown was our governor the first time around. We had no allies. It was a slam dunk. And in the middle of that, we wrote the nation's first organic food law, which was completely attacked and bastardized by a wide group of conventional community people. And they're going to continue to do that. They're not going away. But that's no reason to not do that. That was 1979. So we wrote that in 79. We started the ball rolling, which then legitimized it. That's why we have a federal law that originally came out of that process. And sure, every naysayer in the world, they stacked the board every way they could to make sure that their position is dominant. You just have to be dogged and perseverant and not give in to that paradigm, because that paradigm is going to be there. They're not going away easy. I got a big uphill project here to change that whole thing. You know, it's fantastic.
With the move to amend.
Move to amend. Fantastic idea. But this is a big paradigm shift. And, you know, but things take a long time. You know, we staged the first public demonstration against genetic engineering in 1998. That's the first one in the United States. That's only, what, 17 years ago, 16 years ago? 16 years ago.
16.
Yeah. And when we did it, we dumped genetically engineered corn on Sansom Street in front of the Pacific Stock Exchange and cleaned it up with hazmat suits. Big photo op. You know what? Even the left-wing liberal media didn't get it. We couldn't get them out there. They didn't understand what this whole issue was about in 1998. Now, lots of people understand about it. So that's actually not a very long time in the course of history. And we've all done it. This is political novices with little or no money. It requires human ingenuity, innovativeness to do this, and perseverance. But just the fact that the deck is stacked, that actually just stimulates me. I think so much the better. You know, like I said, working with little farms in the 1970s, and I started a farm supply specifically because you couldn't buy any organic farm supplies. And then all of a sudden, people started wanting from all over the states looking for organic farm supplies. Why'd they do that? It was because they had a desire to grow the thing, so they couldn't find it. Going out to their local farm supply, they couldn't find it. Well, I've been going around visiting farm supplies around the island, working on promoting my class I'm teaching next week, and every conventional farm supply has organic farm supplies in it now. That's a total change. That's, you know what I went into? The people that sell out there to the west side, I went in there, you know, the poison pit, and what are they selling? Well, they've got conventional stuff, you better believe it, but they got organic stuff too, because they see a market developing and they see consumers and farmers wanting that. So that's a big change. And I started the first organic farm supply in the United States. There's nobody doing it. Now there's hundreds of them. It's all over the place. So what I mean by this is that you have to be perseverant, and you have to ignore the odds. You have to just go for it. You have to say, well, so what if the deck's stacked? Well, if there's two voices on that 9 out of 11, those two voices have to get real loud.
Well, I know I did write my letter to the Congress, and I definitely voiced that I thought it was stacked. So before they make this ratified, before they pass it into law, I'd like to see them change the stacking of it. And we did have some very strong success with a recent bill that was about home birthing, where the vast majority of the people on that council would be people who are steeped in hospital births.
I read about that.
And then so it shifted. So I'm hoping that there's motivation out there that helps to shift that board before it gets taken into a full policy element.
So that requires activists to get up and say, hey, we want to make sure we're all represented at the table and that it's not a stacked vote. That's a big challenge.
And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea K284AL Holly Eva. And Amigo Bob is on here with me. And Larry Schneider's in here, too. Larry, do you have any thoughts on this issue?
I'm just loving listening to you speak.
Well, thank you.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Well, I'm seeing here, you gave me a little bit of your family history, and you said your name's Italian, but I see that you're actually, you have a Spanish background.
Yes.
Also. And you're...
Well, the Italians married the Spanish.
The Italians married the Spanish. Yeah. Okay. But you said you have 9 generations of ancestors in California.
Yeah.
So the border didn't cross, you didn't cross the border crossed you.
There was no border.
There was no border.
Yeah. My family came in the 1760s.
The 1760s.
The original Spanish conquistadors that settled California and essentially farmed it, ranched it, part of the Spanish army, the Moragas, before it was a state.
Before it was a state. And is California happy with their statehood? Is it an issue like it is in Hawaii?
Oh, no, there's a lot of issues going on. In fact, there's a large group in the northern part of California looking to either secede or to separate from Southern California. And just the other day, I saw a whole article about a proposal for creating 5 states out of California, which would be really interesting. I'm not quite sure where that's all headed. No, people are, although I don't think it's quite as vociferous as I think it is right here. I'm amazed by the activism that I've heard here on the radio station and other places. People are really motivated here to make some change, and they should be. I think the things that have been done with Hawaiians are just criminal, and there needs to be some real serious restructuring of that system. And we have had that to some degree with Native Americans in California. That's been some improvement, but it's a long ways from being viable.
Well, I think that what at least I've been able to witness being in this program here, this Kauai Soapbox Live, is callers call in or contact me in different ways. I try and investigate the accusations that they're making. Usually it's people calling with a concern. And even on the GMO issue, 2 years ago, I just said I don't like acronyms, so I didn't pay very good attention to it. But I have really come to learn that it seems like a pretty clear issue, that it isn't that much up in the air of whether there is some damage that happens, at least as far as I can see. And I have spoken to many, many, many scientists on it now and policymakers. We do have another caller, so
yes, it's much more clear the issues, and unfortunately there's very little actual research done in a broader spectrum on these. There's a lot of pieces here, but I wanted to speak to how things change. 3 years ago I was on here on the island, actually 3 years ago this month, and I participated in a GMO protest out in front of the airport.
Mm-hmm.
In Lahui. There's about 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 30 people to what happened last year. We missed it because we left here right before the big march. But, you know, a groundswell happened here literally in 2 years' time. You know,
mm-hmm.
Things changed. So.
I would say we've had 5,000 people who have gone to, you know, either one of the big marches or the Vandana Shiva event.
Mm-hmm.
Pam Larry came out from California, the person who helped to do Prop 37, and same with Andrew Kimbrell. We've been lucky that the world is looking at us. I call it activation tourism. Like we're getting a lot of that. Let's see what this person has to say.
Please.
Aloha,
hey,
you're
amigo Bob and Felicia.
Hi.
My name's Don Heacock. Bob, we've actually talked over the years.
Yeah, hi, Don.
Through email.
Yeah.
I'm a member of the Hawaii Farmers Union. I agree with everything you said. And I have to go dig up some Samoan coconuts for a friend right now, but I want to suggest come back as soon as you can, work with the Hawaii Farmers Union. Let's go to the state legislature. Let's go to the county councils, county by county, and let's have a little forum on ecological agriculture that will benefit Hawaii's local people economically ecologically and culturally.
Maybe we can do it before you leave.
Yeah, I don't know if we can do it before you leave, Bob.
No, I'll probably have to come back. But thank you, Don. I'd love to be involved in that. Thanks for asking.
You should be on that panel. So should Hector Valenzuela.
Oh, yeah.
And I could name, you know, six others, and so could you. But we're at a tipping point where people's consciousness are, in general, are finally getting it.
Yeah.
I can't say my veterinarian's name, but he's very intelligent. I love the guy. But he said there's no scientific group that have demonstrated that GMOs are not healthy for people or the environment. And, of course, the second I got off the phone with him, I texted Hector Valenzuela, and he sent me a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll send them to my vet tonight. But there's a lot of this is not a scientific debate. The science is very clear.
Yes.
It's really down to religious beliefs. And, I mean, we even had somebody at the GMO debate stand up and say, quote a section in the Bible where we're to conquer nature and dominate it and spray all the poison we want.
Mm.
And I just thought, oh, you poor guy. I hope they let you in through St. Peter's Gate someday. But, we really need, like you, you're a great model, amigo, muchas gracias, and we need to keep the education inertia going.
I totally agree.
Later.
Thank you, Don, and I'll be happy to help you. Contact me
off
air,
Felicia can help coordinate
Absolutely.
That. I'm sure Kauai Community College would co-sponsor it through their Performing Arts Center that seats 1,000 or 2,000 people, and we'll get it on Hoike Public Access TV and share it with all the counties.
All right.
Already have a memorandum of agreement to do that.
Thank you for sparking that challenge.
Okay, brother. I got to go now, but mahalo. Muchas gracias and hasta luego, amigo.
Go dig up some of those coconuts. That's good news.
Yeah. Yay. Thank you. I do want to make a statement that there is a lot of science that says this is challenging. But the way that it is all discredited seems to get swept under the rug, and Larry's been very clear about how to frame this too, is that they call it anecdotal when we see a big trending long term. The conclusive studies are short, acute, 90-day studies because there is some ethics in being able to test something for 90 days. But you can't take, a lifetime or 20 years or entire pregnancy and intentionally expose people to a harmful level of chemicals to be able to look at it. And when you're looking at a long time, how do you know that it isn't the cigarettes that they smoked or their cell phone or whatever other elements that get in there? So that's a non-conclusive study. Larry?
And the other factor, which isn't addressed by the regulatory agencies, which they use to defend their position, is the cumulative effect.
Sure.
If you try to get an aspirin through the FDA with social media today and as many people who get involved, you'd have vehement arguments on both sides. But then if you start combining it with other drugs and other issues, and that during the testimony, the analogy of beer and beer being regulated, how that fit into it. And my thought was beer's regulated at a federal level, but if someone puts a narcotic in your beer unwillingly or unknowingly, that creates a different set of circumstances than the beer itself, and it requires a different set of eyes to look at things. Mm. I think that there's plenty of concern long-term when you're mixing things, and you're mixing things that are unknown, constantly changing, and constantly introducing foreign subjects into bodies, which respond to foreign subjects through inflammatory reactions.
Sorry.
And that mixing pot that you create these mutations in is not separated from the utilization of pesticides. And I think that one of the things they try to do is they try to segregate every element. But when you put it together and say you've got a new species that didn't exist in nature that no one in the ecosystem has had time to adapt to, and you mix it with multiple components, and then which include other chemicals, other mutations. I have no idea how anyone who's intellectually honest says that they know that there's no health effects.
Well, my guess is intellectually honest people are not the ones who get the podium. You know, the intellectually honest are not getting funded to do this kind of research. They are the ones that tend to be marginalized. The people who get funded to do the research that defend pesticides or defend genetic engineering are basically funded by the corporations that have the vested interests. I mean, that's clear. You don't have to look very far to see how many documents are written specifically by someone who's on a payroll, indirectly or directly, from a corporate interest. So getting someone who's an educated scientific person to do research without getting that funding is extremely difficult.
Well, you also have to know what you're studying.
Well, of course.
And that's another huge variable. That if you purposely build into the design for protection of trade secrets, the secretness to be able to keep your product covert, how in the world can anyone in a decision-making in the legislative, how do they expect that there's data available when no one even knows what to study?
Exactly. And the data is so skewed. I mean, when you go to get a pesticide registered in the United States, you, the company, provide the data. The
Correct.
Government doesn't create any of the data. They just review it. Well, you throw out any data that doesn't look good in your favor. You just keep doing enough studies to make sure that you have something that looks right. And this is the same thing with genetic engineering. So the government is not, in fact, doing the research. They're just rubber stamping the information that's provided to them by a vested interest. So as long as that continues, then we're going to get all kinds of things which are not good for us, but are good for the bottom line of a business.
Yes, and we have a quick call in from Kauai Alliance for Peace and Social Justice, who happened to be putting the David Cobb event on today at 6:30, but I think we're going to hear about another event.
Oh, great.
You're on the
hey,
air.
How's it, Felicia and Mr. Snyder and your guests there? This is one of the best programs we've had in a long time.
Thank you.
And this is unbelievable. We're focusing on corporate greed and our ability to organize and fight back. Well, I just wanted to mention real quickly that on Friday, the Kauai Alliance, along with the Raise the Wage Hawaii and the Pride at Work, is showing a movie called Inequality for All. It exposes the widening income gap between the 1% of corporate owners and the vast majority of the people like us. And Robert Reich, it's his presentation, and he's going to be going over this thing. It's a lively documentary, and it's getting played all across the country. And we welcome people to come. It's going to be from 6 to 9, the event, and free, of course, and it's going to be at the Kapaa Public Library, and everybody's welcome. And Mr. Cobb touched on all of these things, and your speakers, even though they're speaking specifically about GMOs and organic farming, it's all about the same thing, about the people fighting for a better life against these corporate monsters that are just ripping off us and the environment. So thank you for giving me the time.
What's the name of the film?
It's called Inequality for All. And if you're not able to make it on Friday night, go check it out on the web, you know, go Google it or something. Inequality for All. The guy's name is Robert Reich, who's put this thing together. He used to be the Secretary of Labor under Clinton, you know, and he was a professor at Berkeley, and he was part of the Occupy movement there and getting the students out to, you know, fight against income inequality and stuff. And it's a show that's been showed to a lot of union members already. And people on Maui have seen it, people on Oahu. And we're going to be showing it for free on Friday. And everybody's welcome to come, you know.
Okay.
So, yeah, Kauai Alliance, Raise the Wage Hawaii, and Friday Work is showing this movie. And all of us have the same issues, basically support each other and all these things. So people can come out to that too as well. So take care, and I'm going to go back to listening to your show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mahalo.
Bye-bye.
And aloha, you're on the air.
Yeah. I read a article. I don't know if it's true or not, but
was the lady, she was a VP for Monsanto, wrote an article, wrote a bill for Monsanto, and then she became the head of the FDA, and then her first job was to authorize the bill that she wrote.
I don't know about that one, but I can tell you one that parallels that story. Michael Taylor, he is now in the Food and Drug Administration, and his task is to is involved with food safety. But previously, Michael Taylor was a lawyer for Monsanto. And during the Clinton administration, he was placed into the Food and Drug Administration and was specifically responsible for authorizing the regulations that allowed the use of genetically engineered hormones in animals, RBGH, the synthetic hormone to stimulate milk production. And that's documented. He came in and did that, and then he went back out of government and went back into the Monsanto Corporation and worked. And now he's back at FDA in charge of food safety. That makes you a little bit nervous, I hope. So that's the one I know about specifically.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was a Monsanto attorney.
That's right.
Any other questions, caller?
No, that was it.
Okay.
That was it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on the air, brother. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, brother.
The thing that I find intriguing, and it's not helped by the nepotism in the industry and the government, is how you have to fight to obtain knowledge, and why do you have to get a law to not be found to be a criminal to understand what you're consuming.
And also how you almost have to fear, and you have to decide not to be afraid. That's what I go through when you're looking at the different videos and you're thinking about the history of what's in there and seeing this wash of organizations that are harvesting your information, selling your information. You know, we have a lot of that, and it's a work to not become silenced by what you're doing, you know, when you're looking at information.
Yeah, but you think about it, a lot of the people, the grassroots organizations, what they the fundamental backbone of them is education.
Absolutely.
And it's people just talking at individual level to other individuals, and it grows, and there's a pushback from government, from industry, but the industry I understand, because you could hurt their profit.
Right.
But the government should be at least honest enough to say, we ought to know, or let's take the time to investigate it. And I'm intrigued that it becomes polarized. You're either for something or against something. And something so complex as the issues that they're developing with the new technology, you can't make simple snap yes or no judgments. They're very complex. They're very,
most of it's very gray.
Very gray. Yeah. So how are bills created that the legislators can't understand? They're not written that any human who doesn't have a law degree can understand.
That's intentional.
Yeah, they're 240 pages long, and they get 50 of these to read.
Yeah,
exactly. And then they take a position where they say, this is science, or this is a radical fringe group that pushes against it. I don't understand that when it,
follow
you could,
the dollar.
Yeah, but you could be a radical fanatic, or are you just a wondering, thinking
human being?
Human being who wants, hey, if I buy a box, if I go into a store, you don't give them $10 and they just hand you a box and say, eat what's inside. You have the right of choice. And that's the part I don't get.
Of course. Well, that's because we've been sold a dream that everything's fine. You know, I actually want to speak to something which is tied to what's went on with the county legislative issue with the GMOs and
the
reporting.
960 ordinance.
Yeah. I came here 20 plus years ago and was shocked at how backwards the pesticide system in Hawaii is. I come from a state that uses a lot of pesticides, California. But we have an incredibly detailed regulatory process, which is completely non-existent in this state. For example, for you, if you want to apply a pesticide in California, you have to get a license. Okay. You have to go take a class. You have to learn how to safely use it.
We set our regulations against California's standards.
I understand
though.
That, and that was great.
I mean, so that's what we do. We say we're held to California
the
standards.
The state of Hawaii needs to have that for all pesticides. Okay, so in California, when you apply that pesticide, you have to report its use, the product, the amount that was applied, and when it was applied, and what field it was applied. You have to do it every month, and that's all public information. You can go on a computer and find out every pesticide applied in your county, and how much, and who was the applicator, and where was it applied. So that's essential. We need to have regulations that restrict the use of materials. Right now, this state, you can combine anything together in a pesticide tank. You can't do that in California. I mean, this is a long list of regulatory processes that we have, including we have our own Department of Pesticide Regulation that when a company gets its product approved by the EPA, which is how they quote unquote get it approved, which is with their data, then it also has to go through the state of California review process. And many products don't get on the market in California because they are inadequately data.
Well, I'm going to make a big point to clarify, if I heard you correctly, basically our Ordinance 960 that we are being sued right now by Syngenta, Dow, BASF, and Pioneer, that it's unconstitutional.
It's already being done.
It's done
in
California. And it sounds like you do you know what your ordinance number is? So we can.
Oh, there's a whole wide range of them. We'd have to go look that up. There's many, many ordinances. We're talking about books of documents here. This is
because that's what we're asking for. That's what we're asking for. It sounds like you already have it in California.
Yeah, so you
can start with asking for the same thing.
The Department of Pesticide Regulation is where you'll find out where the regulations and the California Department of Food and Agriculture, those are the two regulatory agencies that control pesticide use in California. And the reporting and the labeling and the training. Oh, and farm worker safety. I just took a picture yesterday watching these guys spray a fungicide on a lawn with nothing, absolutely no protection. They were wearing nothing, no masks, no gloves, short sleeve shirts. That's completely illegal in California.
If someone finds out, but there's not enough people.
Well, yeah,
in the regulatory agency to do that oversight.
Well, I would agree. I mean, you have to first have a regulation, though. If you don't even have that, there's never going to be any incentive. So there's not even that incentive here. You know, yeah, there are people that are wantonly using pesticides in California, too, but at least there is the threat of action. And you and I can say something, hey, I saw something happening over here, and you can get some action taking place by your county ag commissioner. So these are basic rights. I mean, there's not even an issue about these, and they should be available to everybody in this state.
So we're almost at the end of our show. I have one more caller that we are taking. Aloha, you are on the air. Thank you for holding.
Hey, aloha, folks. One of the hosts a minute or so ago stated they can understand why the corporate agenda is as it is, but, you know, why the political agenda. And basically, you know, it's called fascism. You know, when corporations are in bed with the politicians and so married together to their agenda, that's what happens. And that's where I think one place the conservative agenda is very correct. Big business, big government just doesn't work. The larger a country gets, the more ineffective and corrupt big government gets. So a lot of times people on the left, you know, could be seduced by something that sounds like it's a really good idea, a compassionate idea. But if the government's involved because of this, you know, fascist relationship that exists with corporations, you can't trust the government to implement even what sounds like good policy.
I think it goes deeper than trusting. I think that the bills are so complex in their language that I think we've got a government that makes policy without understanding what they're voting on.
Well, that's why we need to get rid of big government. That's another way of looking at it.
We need to streamline the way bills are written also so that they're understandable.
Well, sure, but if their agenda is corrupt, there's a purpose for writing bills in ways that you can wiggle out of it. That's what lawyers do. They write a law so that it's to their advantage, but that they can wiggle out of it when it's not to their advantage. It just goes on forever. So basically, you just need to keep big government out of the way. I mean, look at the things they're doing with schools, with food, with all the basics of society and culture. They've got their hands in everything, and they basically seduce people with, oh, yeah, you know, we care about you, and this is a compassionate gesture, whether it's Obamacare or whatever it is. And in the end, we're just watching our culture and our individual freedoms get eroded.
Well said. Yep. Well, thank you.
How long have you been farming?
Since 1975.
Thank you, caller.
So, oh, I'm sorry. I thought the caller, I apologize.
Okay.
One of the things that's repeated by the industry is we follow the law, we follow the label. You've been farming for 40 years. Do you know of any labels that speak of combination pesticides that are used?
No, there aren't.
So how
that's a
so
total,
it's a fallacy,
it's a total fallacy.
And it's
when you take mixed things, which is the term used in agriculture, you are regulated to a degree in California. The federal government doesn't regulate you at all, and Hawaii doesn't regulate you either. You can essentially put anything in a tank you can physically put in there. And so then we know nothing about its synergistic effects when you put 6, 8, 10 things in a tank together. Even if we think we know a little bit about the one product that they might have gotten registered. No, that's a total fake.
Here's the million-dollar question. It's so common sense to people who take a second to step back and think about it. Why does it occur?
Oh, because common sense is at an all-time low. You know, I mean, we're literally the wealthiest nation. We have all the dollars and none of the cents. You know, we're in an odd spot in our society, you know. And thank goodness we have community radio. I want to speak one last thing. You know, I'm on a community radio station in our county. KVMR. We get this conversation out in our county. That's why our county's got its politically diverse agenda. This county has it too. Thank you for this radio station doing that. And people who are listening, you need, as David said earlier, you need to support this. This is really important.
It is community supported. It is dominantly paid for by listeners with their $10, $20 donations more so than it's not public radio. We do get a grant that helps with some of the emergency equipment, but it is the community listeners that support it.
Thank you, community.
Yeah, one of our community members, Masha, I don't even know how to say your last name, Guggenig. She's really an Austrian. She has an art program called Hawaii Beyond the Wave and Hawaii Beyond the Postcard, and she's going to be in here soon on a show, but she's been taking images around the world, actually, talking about what's going on here in Kauai with the 2491 effort and the citizens' activity towards trying to reclaim the use of their lands. So she's at hawaiibeyond.wordpress.com, and she will be in Vancouver on March 5th. So that is another element of this traveling exhibit. So thank you, Masha, for bringing art around the world, exposing what's going on here. We actually get a lot of attention from different places. People are coming here because this island is awakening. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that the radio station has a part of it, but really the radio station is a reflection of the activism that is here as well. You know, it's a synergistic piece. We are a reflection of what the people are saying. And as I was saying earlier, even becoming aware of the politics behind the sovereignty movement and looking at the issue that really happened to them, it is from callers helping me to see that it is very complex of maybe it's not complex. It's actually pretty clear of what did happen. And they do have a right for their claim that this was not brought into the state in the way that is sanctioned by our own government. We're going to be hearing the county council report in just a moment. I just need you both to do a very quick last comment.
Oh, well, first off, I'm honored to be on. I'm really glad that you have this conversation on this wide range of topics. Thank you, Felicia. And also just to say, thank you also, to say that I'll be talking gardening tomorrow on the Gardening Show with Robin, which is specifically about what I'm going to be speaking on next week at WIPA on the, a week from today at 8:30, which is about how to become a better organic gardener and farmer. So I'll be talking about it tomorrow on the Garden Show.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us.
I just want to thank the Amigo Bob and David Cobb and the callers today. I thought that between the callers and the community and the guests, those people created a great show.
Yep, I'm honored.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let's hear the county council report. And after that, we'll be hearing Richard Fernandez play some jazz with us. So that's wonderful. This has been KKCR Hanalei, KEQA Kilauea, K284AL Holly Eva.
Aloha, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's a county council report for the week of February 24th. There will be a special council meeting and a regular council meeting this week. The special meeting will be at 8:30 on Wednesday, and the regular meeting will be at 9, also on Wednesday. The meetings will be in the council chambers at the historic county building in Lihue. The special meeting is to interview Bradley Murayama for a position on the Fire Commission. Here are a few highlights from the regular meeting agenda. The county attorney wants an additional $75,000 for special counsel. This is draft bill 2533 and is also under bills for the first reading. This office also wants another $155,000 for special counsel in several civil cases. Councilmember Yukimura transmits for council consideration and approval a resolution acknowledging the necessity to expedite permit processing for workforce housing. This is also received for the record under committee reports. Council Chair Fafaro requests the Civil Defense Manager provide the Council with a briefing and update on the new tsunami evacuation maps. The Environmental Services Public Safety Community Assistance Committee has on their agenda Bill 2516 Draft 1 for an ordinance related to barking dogs, and this was approved as amended. The Finance and Economic Development, Tourism, Visitor Industry, Small Business Development, Sports and Recreation Development, Other Economic Development Areas Committee has on their agenda approved amendments to the budget for approximately $2.7 million for bargaining unit increases, and this is also under bills for the second reading. They also have on their agenda Bill 2520 relating to real property taxes, and this was approved as amended. Bills for the second reading include Bill 2515, Draft 1, relating to integrated solid waste management. This was deferred from the 12th of February. And also Bill 2516, Draft 2, related to barking dogs. Also on their agenda are bills relating to the bargaining unit fund adjustments. There will be a non-public executive session. Subjects include a briefing by the county attorney on the Tim Bynum civil case, also a briefing on the Ernesto Passion civil case, and three other civil cases. If the council is not finished with this meeting by approximately 1:30 p.m., it will recess for public hearings on Bill 2529. This is for an ordinance relating to the operating budget of the County of Kauai, State of Hawaii, for the current fiscal year, revising the amounts estimated in the general fund. This is Police Department, Workers' Compensation, Medical, for the amount of $110,000. After the hearing, the council will reconvene to complete any unfinished business. For more information, visit the county's website at www.kauai.gov. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News.